headsets. They're very much like virtual reality headsets. They block out other light. I can see everything.
I'm so pleased for you, Stephen. It's just fantastic, and I hope this opens up the game to you and a lot of other people with visual impairments. Thank you so much for being with us, Stephen. That's Stephen Anderson there, who used these goggles for the first time.
The voice of the UK
and the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. Lebanon says Israeli airstrikes have now killed almost 500 people, including 35 children. It's been the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly two decades. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, told Lebanese civilians to leave locations used by the armed group Hezbollah. But the Lebanese health minister, Firas Abeid, said for many, the warning came too late.
If you look at the areas that were targeted, the vast majority, if not all of them, were civilian areas. And even, you know, if you look at the time between those messages that were sent and the time the attack started, you could see that this was not serious at all. I mean, the aim was just, in my opinion, is a show.
Rachel Reeves has used her first Labour conference speech as Chancellor to rule out a return to austerity when she sets out her budget next month. She stood by her cuts to winter fuel payments for many pensioners, insisting tough decisions were needed. But she also said that Britain's best days lay ahead. As the Chancellor spoke to delegates in Liverpool, it was announced that nurses in England have rejected the government's award of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said its members didn't feel valued, but the RCN's General Secretary, Nicola Ranger, insisted the timing of the announcement wasn't deliberate.
We knew that our ballot for our members closed on Friday, and we informed both the government and the Treasury that those results would be coming out on Monday. So we did warn them in advance, and it wasn't a deliberate attempt to sabotage the speech.
A United Nations report has found that Russians are now subject to systematic human rights violations, with all dissent brutally repressed. The investigation was carried out by the UN's special rapporteur on Russia, Mariana Kaczorova, who interviewed activists and lawyers in the country. She said punitive sanctions were being imposed for the most minor activities.
7 years for reading an anti-war poem or producing a play perceived to be anti-war. Two women are still in prison for that. 7 years for posting on social media a United Nations report about the Ukraine war. Journalists being imprisoned for up to 22 years on trumped-up charges and as a warning to others.
A mother and daughter from Middlesbrough have been jailed after taking part in a riot while out walking the family dog. Amanda Walton, who's 52, and 24-year-old Megan Davison admitted violent disorder during the rioting in the town in August. They were jailed for 22 months and 20 months respectively. And Britain's biggest building society, Nationwide, says first-time buyers will be able to request a mortgage up to six times their income from tomorrow. But the bank said it would only be available for those taking out a 5 or 10 year fixed-rate deal. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past 11.
Hello. I'm Nihal Arthur-Nyker.
Headliners.
We go deep with the biggest names in entertainment, culture and the arts. And I'm not trying to boast here, but look, it is what it is. Huge guest,
the comedian's comedian, Stuart Lee. I was going to be a stand-up comedian, but I would be different to the others because I would only tell the truth.
Headliners with Nihal Arthur-Nyker. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, good evening. 3 minutes past 11. Welcome to Weeknights on BBC Radio 5 Live. It's Johnny A. Anson here, in for Gordon Smart tonight. Thoroughly looking forward to speaking to our midnight musicologist, Dr. Beat, Professor Joe Bennett. Professor Bennett is brilliant. It's such a great listen and so much fun to do this. In an hour's time, he'll be with us to go through tonight's theme. In fact, he'll stop by the show in the next half hour or so just to give us a little tease about what to expect after midnight. Before that, though, Monday nights are a time when we shed light on skeletons in the cupboard. It's the Five Live Amnesty. This is based on the rule in Gordon's family that if you confess to something that you did more than 10 years ago, then you can't be done for it. You're above criticism. The statute of limitations, if you will. Two guests each week will share their own stories with us to test the principle of forgiveness. And if you have your own funny story, if you want to just purge yourself, cleanse your soul, then get in touch with the programme and share it with us tonight. You can be anonymous, that's fine. 850-58 is the number to text, or you can send us a WhatsApp on 08085 909 693, unburdening themselves tonight are the comedians Callie Beaton and Gráinne Maguire. Hello, Callie, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's lovely to be here, Johnny.
It's a joy to have you on here. And Gráinne as well, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very anxious and guilty.
Are you?
Already.
I wanted to just sort of test the room. Are you feeling optimistic at the opportunity, though, just to really rid yourself of the guilt? Because I know what you're going to say. And whilst excellent, some may say they make you terrible people as well. So I'm looking forward to being able to cleanse your soul. Callie, you're feeling hopeful that this is going to offer you that sense of liberty that you've been longing for so long?
I feel maybe I've got a really poor moral compass because I'm feeling confident. I'm like, look, I've done this. I think maybe because the thing I did wrong is over 10 years old. I'm like, according to Gordon, this is fine. I don't know according to Johnny how it will be, though. So time will tell.
Yeah, absolutely. Callie, what have you been up to recently?
Well, I've been podcasting. We've just started a new season of the pod. I can't say the name of the podcast.
Well, you can say know what it is. You can say 50% of the name of it.
Yeah,
you
can say, I can say Namaste.
Namaste.
And then if you look up Callie Beaton podcast, Namaste, you will see the rest because we don't want Johnny banned.
Yeah. Even for late night radio, we can't go near that word.
Can't go near the word.
I love
it. But you
it,
can
though.
Go... You can go near the content. So yeah, we've just come back with a new season. So we had Esther Ranson last week. So Grayson Perry this week.
I love Grayson Perry. Yeah, I mean, I love Esther Ranson as well, obviously, but I particularly love Grayson Perry.
Yeah, he was amazing. We've just had Miriam Margolyes. So
oh, fantastic.
We are up and running with the podcast, and I'm writing a book with the same unmentionable name as the podcast. I don't know if I should come up with a new name because if I can't promote it,
yeah,
why am I doing it?
That's going to be fun in the interviews.
Is that exactly at the literary festival circuit with all sorts of words.
What's the premise of it? What's your angle with it?
Well, I've tried to do, it's kind of what the podcast is. I reinvented from many years in boardrooms in telly, and I've tried to sort of combine boardroom life with reinvention, with comedy, with being a woman in my 50s. And basically, it's a sort of modern manifesto to defy stereotypes and do whatever it is we want to do in the world.
Oh, good on you. Gráinne, what have you been up to? Podcasting, obviously.
There's a theme. We're just sort of wrapping up the last of our series of The Way They Were, a podcast about celebrity breakups. Not just celebrity breakups, sort of just famous romantic splits from history. So it's been really, really fun.
I mean, I love the breadth of this from J-Lo and Ben Affleck, which you could do an entire series on, considering...
Oh, we have. We've done many parts.
How many breakups they've had. But then you could do something like Angelina and Billy Bob, Madonna and Sean Penn, and then Lisa Simpson and Nelson, which is...
That. We actually got really, with couples like that, you think, oh, that's going to be a really funny episode. And halfway through, you're like, I just think, you know, Lisa just thought she could change him. And ultimately, you just can't change Nelson. He is who he is. And unless he changes and grows, he's not going to be the man that Lisa deserves to have.
What was your favourite relationship to dissect that you've done so far? I think you've done about 100, haven't you?
We've done quite a few. I really loved our Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah. It's just, they're such idiots. I think we forget because they're so beautiful and so glamorous and so talented that they were like, imagine being friends with them. Imagine what a nightmare that would be. That'd be a lot of like late night phone calls from Liz going, oh, I'm never taking him back.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then you go, yeah, good, good. And then the week later, you're like, oh, Richard, hey, nice to see you.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen Elizabeth Taylor on a WhatsApp group. That would have been,
God.
I could only imagine the stuff you would get from the group chat on that. It would be so fun. So we'd love as well, as we say, people listening to share the secrets that you have, if you just want to get it off your chest. It doesn't have to be the 10-year rule. It can be something you've done last week. We're not judging here. It's a very broad church. 850-58 is the number to text, or 08085 909 693. Should we start with Callie, we're going to start with you, I think. Let's go first for your story and which you'd like to seek forgiveness for. What are you going to start with?
Okay, well, both my stories are about dating, which tells you a lot about my life. But, you know, look, I'm 55. I've had a long time of dating, so I've got stories. So this particular story is I was an early adopter of online dating. So before there were the apps, I was doing like Guardian Soulmates. And so I've been in the online dating world a very long time. And whenever I went on online dates, and hopefully people are still all doing this now, to make sure you're safe, obviously you tell a mate where you're going, who you're going with, so that you're safe, you're backed up. So you've got a wing person. I turned up at this one day in a pub in North London. I met the guy who immediately started telling me about Victorian plumbing that was underneath the pub we were in. And it turned out he was quite the Victorian plumbing fanatic. So he went to get drinks at the bar. And while he was at the bar, I texted my wing woman and I said, shorter, older, more boring than his profile, and quite the expert on Victorian plumbing. Only as it turned out, it wasn't her I had texted, because I got a message right back saying, I'm not that short or old. I can talk about things other than Victorian plumbing. Do you want ice in your drink? So that was, and I couldn't even leave because the bar was between the table and the door. So I couldn't even just sneak out without literally nearly knocking him over. So I had to stay. And actually, it got even slightly worse, because then when he came and sat down with the drinks, I had my phone mistakenly still face up on the table. And my friend sent a meme of a piston engine that was, anyway, so it was
the fact, what I will say is the fact that he texted you back with that and then asked if you wanted ice, I would have immediately said that that makes him a keeper.
Well, he obviously isn't a keeper, because he's not here in the next room.
No, right. I thought that was going to be the big payoff. I thought that was the punchline. And here he is.
Yeah. No, he is, as Grania knows, my dating life is still disastrous. But I never did hold on to the Victorian plumbing expert. But I did have a nice evening with him. And I can't even remember his name. So I couldn't even ask him for forgiveness, even if I wished to. Maybe he's listening.
Grania, can you, I mean, is that a fair one to ask for forgiveness for?
I think so. There was no malice behind it.
Yeah.
You know, it was just an accident. It was a slip of a finger. And I think he took it, you know, in a great sense of humour. And I think, again, Callie, I say this with love, I think he's the one that got away. And I think it's an amazing start to a rom-com.
It really is, yeah.
It's very forgivable, I think.
I did something very similar. This was way before internet dating. This was only just as mobile phones became kind of common use. And I text what I thought was my friend, and I text the girl that I was out on a date with. I was complimentary, far more complimentary than you were, Callie. And then to try and be a bit playful, I said something that sounded massively egotistical and big-headed about how great I was. But my friends would have known I was being ironic, because I have a huge lack of confidence and a massive imposter syndrome. But it didn't come across that way. And so I said to her, I've just sent you a text message. Can you just delete the message without looking at it? And she said, yes, of course. But obviously she then just went into a deleted message box and read it back in the day, because it was an old Nokia, and just read the message. And that didn't really go very far, that relationship, sadly. But I know the pay. I guess it's like that reply all email or something like that, Callie, that when you send it, you just can't believe you've done it.
I couldn't even bring those to the table tonight, because even Grania, who's the kindest, nicest soul, could not have voted to forgive me for some of those. So this was mild by comparison.
Grania, have you ever had anything similar happen to you?
You know, I'm just getting flashbacks. When I was at university, there was this guy called Chris, who I thought was really, really cool. And I was like,
cool,
his
Chris.
Friend, but I really fancied him. But then there's this one night where I had a bit of a kiss with this other guy called Chris. And then the next morning, my friend said, oh, Chris is on the phone. So I grabbed the phone. I was like, oh, my God, I kissed the biggest nerd last night. Oh, my God, it's so embarrassing. And then he said, that was me.
That's excellent. That is not forgivable, Grania.
I still feel sick every time I think about it, nearly 20 years ago. And I want to just peel my skin off. I'm so ashamed.
Tell me that nerdy Chris is in the next room, though, and there was some happy ending with this.
He's now president of Ireland.
Well, Callie, it sounds like Grania is up for forgiving you. I'm going to forgive you on that one. But I'm not forgiving you for letting him go. So it's a it's a double-edged one for me. That I agree, like Grania, I think he's the one, and I think there is your next podcast is trying to find sad, geeky Victorian plum man. And
maybe we're finding him now. If this was the Richard Curtis movie, yes, he would be listening.
Absolutely.
And this is where it would all start again. So never say never.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Richard Curtis, actually, the man that put together Love Actually, because one of the stars of that features in Grania's story, unless I'm not mistaken, Grania.
Yeah, it's true.
This is almost like it was planned, Callie.
What a segue.
This is a thing of beauty.
This is slick.
Take it away, Grania.
Okay, so we must go back to a magical time, mid-noughties London.
Love those times.
Grania has just stepped off the ferry, fresh from Ireland, seeking her place in the city. So I got a job working as an usher in a theatre. Now, ushers do not earn a lot of money, but I was like, I'm in a theatre, I'm working in the West End, this is so glamorous. So there was a Christmas party, and everybody who worked in the theatre, no matter what, how lowly you were, was invited along with the cast. So in the cast, the play was Chris Marshall, star of Love Actually and Death in Paradise and the BT ads. And so I was very nervous and all these glamorous London people. So I decided to just throw myself at the free bar because how could that turn out to be a bad idea? So I was drinking more, but it was like, you know, like those, it's a very intimidating place. So I was trying to chat to people, but nobody wanted to chat to me because I just sold programs. So then I started telling everybody, and I heard myself say it before I realized. I said, oh yeah, I worked for Private Eye. Like really good friends at Enos Lop. And then suddenly I was talking to the cast and I was drinking. Chris Marshall was there. I was like, oh my God, I'm living my London life. And then the drink just turned on me. It turned on me. And I don't know why I did it. I think I hadn't eaten that day. I'm going to blame that. I then started getting really mean. And I don't know why I was so mean. And I started saying to Chris Marshall, you think you're funny, but you're not funny.
Oh no!
Funny, but you're not actually that funny.
But he was funny, Grania. He is funny.
I was 25 and I was so drunk. And everybody's going like, why? Why has Ian Hislop's friend been so mean to Chris Marshall? But then Chris Marshall sort of realises that maybe I'm not my best headspace. So he orders a taxi to send me home, right?
Stop it.
I waddle away, see you guys, get into the taxi. The taxi drops me to my door. And remember, I work as an usher in London. What do I not have? Money. So I tried to pay for the taxi with a Discman. And it turns out a Discman is not legal tender. So then the taxi driver brought me back to the Christmas party and Chris Marshall had to come out and pay so I would go away.
Oh, my. There are so many aspects to that story that I want to dissect. Firstly, the Private Eye thing, where did that come from? Why Private? Because that is such an easy lie to debunk.
But I think it was because I think that's what that was my plan. I thought when I moved to London, I would become best friends at Sienna Miller and get a job working for Private Eye. That would be it. And it was like a North London theatre. It seemed sort of cool. And yeah, that I think that was the logic behind that one.
And then telling him he wasn't funny. Where did that anger come from? That was obviously something that has obviously been just eating away at you up to that point. Because you would have seen him in Love Actually at that point if it was the mid-noughties.
Yeah.
He would have been in My Family, been a big star at that point.
I was being really mean and horrible. And this is why I shouldn't drink spirits or free wine, because I was mean and really horrible. And then there was an Irish actor in the play doing sort of a received pronunciation accent. So then I turned on him and I was like, are you ashamed to be Irish? Why are you pretending to be English? What's wrong with your own accent?
And then the fact that you had insulted him on several levels, that he then paid for your taxi home when the discman wasn't accepted by the taxi driver.
Yeah, he really did. And I've never... It's all, and the worst thing, he keeps popping up on my television. I'm so ashamed.
Do you know the thing I like about person. It? Yeah, well, the thing I like is celebs obviously meet loads of people. And they'll always be like, oh, I met you once outside the Hammersmith Apollo. Do you remember you shook my hand? But he probably genuinely remembers you and your story, Gráinne. That's the thing. He, like, much like you're telling this story, he probably tells that story to his celebrity friends when he's at the BAFTAs and stuff like that.
I mean, I don't think it's a meet cute. I don't think we're going to get together.
Callie, thoughts on that story?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's awful on every level, Gráinne, and you're a really bad person. Not the person I thought you were, but the bits that I find extenuating are twofold. One is that you were 25, and don't we all look back at us at 25 and think we deserve an amnesty on almost everything?
That's 7 years above the legal adulthood age, Callie. I'm not having that. She's not 15.
But they're not adults, are they? I mean, you know, we weren't, they're not. So I just feel that she was young and she was homesick. She was in big, bad London, homesick and earning very little money. So I think there was a lot going on, clearly, and it all erupted out of you that night. And I'm just mostly trying to equate this to who I think you are now. So I love it as a story, and I have to forgive you. I have to forgive you because you've redeemed yourself over the many years since.
Oh, let me play this one then. I should have played that for you as well, Callie, earlier, by the way.
Yeah, where's my Let It Go?
It's a double Let It Go. I totally disagree. I'm sorry. I think there's a special place in hell for someone that is so awful to Chris Marshall and then makes them pay his taxi, their taxi fare on the way home. What was in the Discman, by the way? Something suitably big naughty. Hearsay, something like that.
I think
Usher.
It was the Sugar Babes.
Sugar Babes. Sugar Babes. Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
So, that's perfect. That really is. All right, Callie, take us to your next story then. A holiday with an ex-boyfriend. Well, kind of a nearly holiday, maybe
it
is the best way.
It was a nearly holiday. Yeah. Yes. So I was going out with somebody at the time. We booked a flight to Reykjavik and we were going to go away for a 5-day sort of, you know, go to the Blue Lagoon, go and see the sights. And we took off from Heathrow, landed in Reykjavik, were waiting in arrivals for our luggage, and he said, I don't want to go out with you. I said, I'm sorry. He said, I don't want to do this anymore. I thought he was joking. He wasn't joking. This did come out of nowhere. He was a bit grumpy. We had an earphone splitter on the plane so we could both watch something. He didn't want to share it. But that was the only indication I got that things weren't going swimmingly. And it was a minor thing. It didn't feel like a relationship rupture. I never did find out quite what led him to say that. But he was really like decisive, got his bag and off he went. I went and got the hire car, was really sort of stunned. So I really don't understand what's happening. Cut a long story short, I decided, well, I'll leave the next day. I can't be here on my own. It was humiliating. I'm a single mum. I didn't want to tell my kids I was coming home. I called my daughter the next morning and said, oh, sweetheart, I'm going to have to come home, and told her what had happened. And she'd just come back from a geography field trip to Iceland. And she said, Mum, you've got to stay. You've got to go and do a trip. It's an amazing place. And I'll like tell me, you can show me the things you do. So anyway, I ended up staying in Iceland on my own, had this amazing holiday, nearly died in a snowstorm, turned a car over, got lost in the snow, ended up doing a hit Edinburgh show the next year, all about it. The man concerned ended up getting in touch with me a couple of days later and saying, well, I've been really going through a sort of crisis and I really want you back. And please, can I come and join you, or can I pick you up in London? And I just want, and I, dear listener, I did not respond to him. I had an amazing, empowering, movie style solo woman's trip and never got back with him. So yeah, and he didn't dump me at departures at Heathrow. He dumped me at arrivals in Reykjavik, which has got to be the ultimate slam to a person's self-esteem.
Well, go sisterhood. Well done, you. We're not looking about whether you should be forgiven, Callie, because quite obviously you did the right thing, staying there and enjoying yourself and nearly killing yourself, but thankfully not. Grainne, the real question is, does Callie's ex... Well, I mean, firstly, the question is, why on earth did he do it there? I mean, what possesses someone to wait until you get to somewhere like Reykjavik to
what
do it?
What an expensive breakup.
Which I was going to say is the most expensive place on planet Earth, by the way.
Yeah, you pay like £9 for a cucumber.
Yeah.
And it's so beautiful. I don't know if you've been to Reykjavik,
yeah,
but
the
airport,
it's amazing.
You see out. So you've got all this amazing landscape where you feel like nothing but beauty and love and romance and mystical things should happen, not grubby breakups at the baggage carousel.
Yeah. I mean, I think I know where this one's going, but Grainne, is there any sense of forgiveness that could be given to the
ex? I'm just curious, how long had you been planning this holiday?
Well, we'd been together less than a year, and I'd say we'd been planning the holiday for 3 or 4 months.
Wow.
That's long enough. That's long enough for a man to make up his mind. If it was like a last minute thing, if it was like your third date and he was like, no, hang on a sec, this is moving too fast, I want to save the Northern Lights for the woman I marry, then maybe I could, you know, have sympathy for his decision, if not forgiveness for it. But
yeah,
the cold thing you spent on holiday with, you know, you skipped the true ice of that man's heart.
Oh, there's so many. You're right. There's so many frozen metaphors.
The metaphor. Don't play Let It Go now.
Well, I was going to say,
too painful.
It's the only thing I'm not going to play connected to Frozen. Exactly. I think we can all agree that he is on the... Yeah! You're well rid, Callie. You're well
rid. Definitely well rid.
You are well. Did he stay in, or did he go home?
He went home. Yeah, so he went home
straight away.
Morning. Ugh. Yeah, he went straight home the next morning, and I was going to go home, but not on the same flight. But
well,
I didn't.
I hope his flight was delayed.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you got something positive out of it. You're a stronger woman and a hit Edinburgh show. So, frankly, I think it worked out for the best. Ever.
Does that mean, Callie, sorry, does that mean your show was then tax deductible because it was in your Edinburgh show?
Listen, Grainne, a lot of things are tax deductible when you're a comedian, as you know.
You'd be amazed.
Yeah.
Grainne, you're going to wrap things up for us then. So we've heard texting on a date, Christmas party, drunkenness and airport dumping. Take us through the things that maybe took an unexpected direction for you. Your latest story.
I feel a bit silly now because it's not like a Scandi noir.
No,
like
it doesn't
Callie's.
Need to be. Doesn't need to be.
It's like it was an everyday betrayal, which, you know, aren't they often the most painful? So it was during last winter, and I'm a cozy girl. I like to make things as warm and as snugly as possible. So I always have a hot water bottle, an extra blanket, sometimes a heated blanket. And so I was just living my best life. But I had noticed there's a weird taste to my tea. Like every day when I made like my afternoon tea, it sort of had this weird rubbery taste. And then one day I said to my husband, I was like, is there something weird with the water? This taste of this tea, it kind of tastes rubbery. And he took a sip and he went, yeah, I guess it does taste a little bit rubbery. And then he paused and he looked at me and said, oh, well, I have been using your hot water bottle to refill the kettle.
No.
At least it wasn't bath water. It could always be worse.
So I've been drinking rubber stewed hot water with tea for who knows how long. I don't know how long it was going on, but he thought it was completely normal that every morning when he, you know, took my hot water bottle from out of the bed, he would pour the contents into the kettle.
I mean, it would have made more sense to put the tea bag in the hot water bottle, wouldn't it? Cut out the middle man.
Don't give him ideas.
And
don't
then
give
just
him ideas.
In the morning, pour that out and put some milk in it. Because frankly, he's trying to do an environmentally friendly thing there, but actually he's just wasting energy by reboiling it.
And why should I call somebody? Like, do you think I'm safe? Is this a sign that he's like a sociopath? I am a bit worried now, I think about it.
I mean, listen, I think in when climate change is such an existential threat that he's trying, I think his heart's in the right place, Grainne. I think maybe the way he's gone about it wasn't necessarily the most appropriate thing. But I think he's trying to do something good, Callie. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm now thinking, why did I let go of a man who talked about Victorian plumbing when there's people out there marrying hot water bottle snufflers? So it's made me reconsider my one. But I think, I feel it must never happen again, Grainne, or you must get divorced. But if he's now learned his lesson, I think he's forgiven. But if he's still doing it, you've got to kick him to the curb and find a new husband.
Big question, Grainne, has he done it since?
And what I have I've kept an eye on my hot water bottle. I empty the water right now every morning just to be on the safe side.
Well, there you go.
Can't take things for granted.
Sounds like he's forgiven to me. I think he deserves it. That was fun, both of you. Thank you. What's next, Callie? What are you up to at the moment?
Well, finishing the book this month.
Oh, yeah,
And doing loads of stuff that the place people most know me from above live at the Apollo and anything else is always Instagram. So if you don't already know what I do on Instagram, me and my dog, Jeff, have a look and you might like what you find.
Get on there. And Grainne, what about you? Which celebrity unconscious couplings are you talking about next?
Oh, well, we've got a good one this week. On Friday, we have Cher and Sonny Bono.
Oh, right. That's a fascinating story.
Really good one.
Yeah, brilliant.
We always decide who wins, and I think you can decide. Yes. Cher definitely won that split.
I think, I think all things considered. Listen, it has been great to talk to you both. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Stay away from those hot water bottles, Grainne.
Thanks
a lot to you both.
Us.
Take care. See you later. Bye-bye. Bye. Callie Beaton there and Grainne Maguire. Check them out on social media. Very, very funny women. Love that. And remember, if you've got any amnesty that you want to just rid yourself of, 85058 is a number to text us. 29 minutes to midnight now. Let's get the latest update from Shabnam.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And here is your news and sports. Health officials in Lebanon say almost 500 people have been killed by Israeli airstrikes and more than 1,600 injured. It's the deadliest day of conflict across the border in nearly two decades. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she'll make hard but fair economic choices, but there'll be no return to austerity in the autumn budget. Speaking to the Labour Party conference, she also defended the decision to means test the winter fuel payment. US prosecutors say the man suspected of planning to shoot Donald Trump on a Florida golf course had written a note saying he intended to kill the former president. They'll try to charge Ryan Ruth with attempting to assassinate a major political candidate. And Harrods is starting an internal review looking at whether any current staff were involved in any of the allegations relating to Mohammed Al-Fayed. A former employee has told BBC News that a manager who failed to investigate allegations of inappropriate behaviour still works for the company. In sports, Everton could soon become the 10th club in the Premier League under majority American ownership. The Friedkin Group have reached an agreement to buy Farhad Mashiri's majority stake in the club, subject to approval from the Premier League, the FA and the Financial Conduct Authority. Manchester City fans are anxiously waiting on news of midfielder Rodri, who was substituted during the first half of Sunday's 2-2 draw against Arsenal. It's feared he could miss the rest of the season after initial tests showed damage to his ACL. City's three defeats last season came without the Spain international in the team. The League Cup tie between AFC Wimbledon and Newcastle has been switched to St James's Park for next Tuesday after the London stadium was affected by flooding. The third round match was due to be played at the Cherry Red Record Stadium on Tuesday night. Four games are still on. Five Live will have commentary of Wycombe Wanderers against Aston Villa. The League Two Lancashire derby between Fleetwood and Morecambe tonight ended in a 2-2 draw. And in cricket, Glamorgan won the One Day Cup for the second time in 4 years as they held on to beat Somerset by 15 runs. That's your latest from BBC Sports, and you can listen on your smart speaker by saying play BBC Sports News.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as the coming storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK.
On digital radio,
on BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Johnny Iamson.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yes, evening. It's Johnny in for Gordon this evening. Just a heads up, if you're in the north of England and listen to 5 Live on 9:09 a.m, there's going to be some essential engineering work tonight on one of our transmitters. It'll happen just after midnight around that time. So to stay with 5 Live, you can find us on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, and of course on BBC Sounds as well. So that's just after midnight tonight. There may be some problems because of essential engineering works on 9:09 a.m. Now, Gordon's not here, but things carry on as normal. That includes our midnight musicology appointment with Professor Joe Bennett from Berklee College of Music in Boston. I love listening to this and I love doing it as well. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Hey there, Johnny. It's good to speak to you. Unexpected pleasure to catch up with you.
Hey,
again.
You and me both as well, surrounded by your electric guitars, acoustic guitars, a couple of ukuleles, I think, unless they're just guitars very far
away.
Yeah,
you're right. Yes, there's guitars on almost every wall of my house, I
can imagine.
Say.
I can imagine. So, how are you? How's things? What have you been up to?
Well, we're back into the deep Berklee teaching semester right now, so I like seeing my students all the time. I've got 70 brand new students, so my challenge at this time of the term is learning 70 names in 2 weeks. That's the special flashcard memory test.
How are the freshmen, as they call them over there? Excited?
They do call them that, yes.
Full of hope and optimism?
Well, I tend to teach, because it's a 4-year degree in America, the degrees are longer. So I tend to teach the sort of the, what they call the juniors and the seniors. So that's the third and fourth years. So they're pretty jaded by the time they come to me. I have to turn on all the energy to get them to stick with it. But, you know, I've got some great students. There's some fantastic talent. I had a DJ in my forensic musicology class last week, and I put this track on, what's the BPM? Is the question I like to ask the class. And he said, oh, 103. And he was spot on.
Really?
So he's got this kind of
the human metronome
that can just hear BPMs. So I love it when you discover, you know, unexpected talent in a new group of students.
Yeah. So what are we talking about tonight then? Last week it was all about songs in 12/8 time signatures. What's this evening?
So this evening we're talking about songs that all have the same title, and the word we're looking at is breathe. It's just a word. You can't copyright a title, you can't copyright a word. And it's one of those words that, because, well, I'm not even sure why it is, but maybe there's something about that word that has been attractive to songwriters. In our research, we found about 35 songs just called Breathe.
Right, so just got, not with breathe in the title, just breathe, singular, that word.
That is the title. So we took a selection from those that to give our usual spread of decades and genres and styles, and some new songs and some old songs and some very familiar songs and maybe some less familiar songs. So we're going to be listening to the Breathe songs all evening.
Great, can't wait for it. And as ever, you'll have your quiz as well. So how does that fit into things?
Okay, so I thought initially we could just grab the word breathe and just play that word to people. I thought that might be too easy. So instead, we went for high concept, and I've extracted the breath from some tracks where the singer just goes, ah,
love it.
And we're just going to listen to that. And you've got to guess the song. So do you want to have a sneak preview?
Yeah, come on, let's do it. Go on.
Let's do it. Okay, so this is, I'll say, it's a rock classic from 1988. You're going to hear a breath and a guitar strum, and that's all you're getting. Here's a preview of number one from 1988, Name the Song. I'll give you that one again. Here it is. Here's the breath. And that's it.
That's tough.
They're all that short. Mostly that short.
That's really tough. I like. Does it sound female? Was that a female vocalist?
You can't tell with breath.
Of course you can't.
The diaphragm isn't there. It's just breath.
I'm going to enjoy this one. That's great. I'll be interested to see if anybody's got that one already. 85058. Brilliant. Can't wait for it. Looking forward to it. Joe, we'll catch up with you in about 25 minutes' time.
look forward to it.
Fantastic stuff. Joe Bennett then with us for our Midnight Musicology appointment just after midnight, as the title suggests, later on this evening on the programme. Now, let's turn our attentions to this news today that a 14-year-old boy caught up in riots sparked by the Southport stabbings avoided punishment after police and prosecutors decided that the wrath of his parents was sufficient. Stephen Parkinson, the Director of Public Prosecutions, DPP, said the telling off that the child received after being frog-marched to a police station was more effective than taking him through the court. So we all have different styles of parenting. Is there one particular way that is a better way? Psychologist Sue Firth joined me earlier to tell me whether a stern telling off is the best way.
When it comes to your children, you do know best. And if that child has a particularly strong connection with their parent or parents, and they are both just as disappointed in him and therefore just as angry, that can carry a great deal of weight for a child. And there is every possibility that that is a better chance of influencing them. And also, you know, they will have taken advice on that and worked it out through parenting experts as well, and therefore really reached the conclusion that actually the strength of that disappointment and anger was probably likely to influence them more.
Mm. So I guess, though, it depends on that child's attitude as well, though, to being told off and how many times they might have received a royal rollicking and then never actually really learnt the lesson.
Yeah, I mean, this is where it gets a little bit tricky. Parenting is an emotionally fraught topic, and the reason is very simple, because none of us are given a manual. Mm. So, you know, when you first have children, you don't stop and think, well, should I? Because I might not be a good parent. That's such a massive topic. So what's more likely is that we just do our best. And our best is a combination of learning both from what we try, what works, trial and error, and possibly even discussions perhaps with friends, but probably not with an expert, because most of the time we'd be a bit humiliated to try and speak to an expert. We'll assume we know best. Mm. So the honest truth is we give it a go. And I think there are some tips, there are some pointers, and one of them without doubt is to get started in teaching your child the rules of the way, that, you know, good from bad, right from wrong, and also rules of how you need to behave really from very young, so that they learn to take you seriously. They learn authority and they learn what that actually means. And that's the starting point, I think.
It's really interesting you bring that up, Sue, because we are, and I say we, me and the other half, are currently trying to teach our four-year-old, boundaries, which is, we're struggling with it, I'll be honest with you. And I think we're struggling with it because it's this notion that you have to be assertive and you have to be really strong. And ultimately, you have to upset them at times. And how much are you setting a child up for failure if you don't set the boundaries of the small stuff early on in their life? And when should that boundary setting start?
I mean, I do think it's important. There's no doubt. I probably wouldn't scare yourself, you know, so say to yourself, okay, I'm setting this child up for a failure, will make you feel as if that child is going to end up in, you know, some kind of situation where they'll be picked up by the police in some kind of ridiculous way. You're only going to scare yourself. But there is no doubt at all that if you can be quite rigid, strong, authoritarian and straight, so keep it simple with a very young child. No, I've said no, I'm not arguing with you. Don't argue back with me. No. And you teach your child very quickly that your voice, your authority, and unfortunately, you do have to stand by that. So by the time they are four or five, they do begin to push you. Mm. And it's that which is important. So if you give them time out, that's how you teach a young child these days. Yeah, that's fine. But you can't give them time out in a room where they can still hear the television. You can't take their phone off them as if that's some kind of consequence. So you have to think of a good consequence such that their behavior then gets punished, however mildly or appropriate, for the significance of the problem. And that is, again, another thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting you mentioned the word authoritarian, because some would think that would be from the parenting style of maybe 30, 40 years ago, when I was a kid, or, you know, when my parents were kids. There is definitely this emotional shift, isn't there, to a less fear-inducing parenting, to something a bit more emotionally driven.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a balance in there. Again, when a child is very young, what I'm talking about when I say authoritarian is the intensity of your authority in your voice. So you have to be strong. You can't be weak.
Right.
You can't say to a child, come on, Joe, you know, and then start trying to reason with a four-year-old. Yeah. Four-year-olds yeah. can't do that. They have to have black and white and simple. And so it's only really as a child gets older and towards being teenage that I think it then becomes critically important that you swap out authority and you will do as you're told simply because I've told you so, to it's now time to actually give them credit. You listen. You need to allow for the fact that they've got an emotional range of responses to something, and that when they're upset, unhappy, angry, frustrated, tired, whatever, that they're allowed to express that, but that they need different tools in their kit bag. They can't just default to one, which is shouting at you. And that's another thing that you've got to learn to do, is not to model behavior that your child immediately copies. And that's, I'm afraid, quite important. So, you know, unfortunately, what's happening instead is that many of us are tired. We're trying to parent our children from the front seat of a car and the child's in the back and you've got no eye contact and you're doing your best to teach them a life skill. I mean, it's just not easy to do.
Yeah, it is. Parenting is not, I mean, that's an understatement. Parenting is not easy. Bringing it back to these, the kids, the teenagers involved in these rights and their punishments. And we've seen the 14-year-old get a telling off and the Director of Public Prosecution say that's enough. At the other end of the spectrum, we've seen the youngest, a 12-year-old, being given a year-long referral order. Now, that would terrify, the idea of going through the courts would terrify many kids. Is there a place in discipline in teaching a lesson, do you think, in that genuine fear of going through the system such as this 12-year-old will have?
I think there's no doubt that something as intense, potentially traumatic, certainly stressful and scary is likely to have a fairly major impact. That particular child, from what I've read, was actually accompanied by their uncle rather than a parent, which does say a lot, sadly. So that child also will learn again that actually none of my parents or neither parent is particularly fussed about this. And that's not necessarily the case, but it all matters. So teaching and training, if that doesn't sound too tricky, is important. It's about making sure that your children at whatever age do understand that there are rules, right from wrong. Mm. And it's blatantly wrong to take part in something that may potentially hurt another person and or even create, you know, mass destruction or violence. It's blatantly wrong.
The difficulty sometimes, though, is you're not just up against bad decision making. You're up against biology, aren't you? When we talk about making good and bad decisions, the part of the brain that does that, the prefrontal cortex, isn't actually fully developed until in the 20s, maybe mid 20s, when it comes to boys, which is often why boys seem to be the ones making bad decisions.
There is some risk of that. It's quite true. Also, testosterone is really a very strong hormone. And when you are with other boys, that testosterone's driven up and up in the presence of adrenaline. So what you think you can do or get away with is likely to be much stronger because your potential, you know, disinhibition, as we call it, meaning the rest of your logic, which would be that problem solving bit you're talking about, which says, no, this is not good for me. I will make an idiot of myself, or I will get hurt, or worse, I'll hurt other people, tends to be reduced when you're up against it, because your competitive drive to please other people is also very, very strong. Social media is not helping with this at the moment, from the point of view that peer pressure is such that young people feel there's something to be gained by winning the favor of another friend.
Yeah.
So you've got to be careful. You've got to be aware. As parents, you need to know, you know, how your child operates, how they think, where they're at risk, what they're likely to be doing, and all of that is quite important. You know, it's a big thing. It's not a short one-stop shop, and it's certainly not a one solution fits all.
Oh, if only it was, though. Psychologist Sue Firth there on the best ways of approaching disciplining your children, or trying to at least create some sort of discipline. It's an ongoing journey, let's say, as a parent of a toddler. 12 minutes to midnight, and you're listening to Johnny in for Gordon on the programme this evening. Now, we're going to touch on something we discussed last night, actually, because it's such a brilliant project. More than 450 players representing 38 nations. It's a festival of football, but more importantly, it's a competition that's about much more than a game. It's the 2024 Homeless World Cup that kicked off over the weekend in Seoul, in South Korea. It's its 19th edition. The organisation's president and co-founder is Mel Young. And last night, he told me the idea behind the tournament.
We have this great competition, and I always say to people, no, you come along and watch it because you'll be blown away. The atmosphere is absolutely magic. But the critical thing for us is the impact. It's about changing lives. And you're right, this sense of belonging, it's a bit like becoming part of a family. And being homeless, you're actually isolated and just trying to get through from day to day. Now you're part of something that's much bigger, and then you potentially get to go to another country. And you know, some of these people have been here, have never been near an airport or an aeroplane. They're coming to another country, and it's just absolutely life-changing for them. And the statistics and stories we have of the players over the years that have changed their lives are really, really moving and importantly, very impactful. And I'm always going on to governments and so on about, look, this sport is a really, really powerful tool, and we don't use it enough effectively to create change. And we're proving through the football that we do that change is really possible through sport.
This is such a great idea. Let's cross live to Seoul now, where it's very early in the morning. We can speak to England coach Frankie Juma, who joins us. Hi, Frankie. How are you?
How are you?
Thanks very much for getting up. I don't think we could have managed to get Lee Carsley or Gareth Southgate up so early in the morning during a big tournament. So we appreciate it. Just tell us what's it like out there? How's the tournament going?
It's a wonderful atmosphere. It's a great chance and a wonderful opportunity, you know, to our players to integrate to more people, you know, from different cultures, background, languages, you know, etc. Share with them this wonderful and beautiful moment. It's such a life changing. And going forward with England team, which is with a solid 5 wins so far, so it's amazing actually.
Yeah,
it's so good.
So you're doing well. I think you battered South Korea 7-0, didn't you? At the start of the tournament. Yeah. So you're feeling confident about your run in this?
Yeah, I'm feeling very comfortable. It's been like a few months actually. 5 or 6 months, being scouting the players, speaking to them, you know, put them together from different backgrounds. We have a very diverse team, which is really good. It's giving a nice dynamic and then good depth as well. And this is showing as well how Team England are. It's such a really wonderful thing, you know, bringing all these people together and having this wonderful moment over the last 5-6 months. It's been something really brilliant for me and for them as well.
We spoke to Mel last night. We just played a clip of him talking about the importance to the players. But I wonder if you can just explain a little bit about what the players are telling you now that they're there, about what a life-changing experience this is.
It's already happening. I think when you're giving someone a purpose and they give them like something they can fight for, or like something they can show, especially like with someone being very vulnerable, you know, not recognized. And then you give them like a sense of belonging and then something you can do. And especially like if they representing the country, I think that this is the best thing ever. And then they really enjoy it. They're so proud of themselves. Every day we have a daily checkup. We talk about to each of us, you know, individually. We talk as a group and then how proud they are. And I'm so excited, you know, to bring it home. And all this stuff, which is really great, actually.
It must be amazing for them, particularly being people who are homeless, being on the outskirts, on the periphery of society, not necessarily feeling that sense of belonging, to be there with you as a team and probably feeling part of a team for the first time in years. Maybe, for some of them, the first time they've ever felt like they belong to something.
That's true. I mean, like, you see, like, sometimes if a homeless person in the street, like, asking for money, or sometimes people not give them any, like, they don't talk to them, they don't give them any smile, maybe anything. And then you being from all this way to go in another different part of the world, and then you're representing your country, you meet people from different background, and you're wearing, you know, the jersey, and telling them, like, listen, I play for my country, and I think all the players, they're enjoying that. And this is something very good. You know, it's really going to impact their life, their mental health, their growth. And as well, I'm sure like every one of them, when they get back again, it's going to be full of energy, full of purposes, and they're going to look forward, you know, to do more stuff.
Yeah.
And I've been seeing over the years, the ex-players of the Homeless World Cup, they carry on and volunteering, coming back to lead their home teams. And this is what I want to implement on the other players. It's like, it's not an ending journey. Your journey is going to continue by doing something for the community, by you coming back again next year as a coach, something like this. So, yeah, something really brilliant and amazing.
And I know that this is something close to your heart, Frankie, because you have a really difficult story yourself. You escaped from Darfur 8 years ago in Sudan. You had to leave your family behind. You had an incredibly difficult journey to make it to the UK. I'm not going to get you to relive that, but I wonder if you could tell us about the importance of having organisations that helped you, that helped you feel part of something and gave you a purpose and a focus.
I think it's really something really amazing. My story is like I never see my family now. It's been 8 years and I really want to see them. But due to war and a lot of things, this is harder. But then when you find a people, organization that treats you as a family, giving you a purpose, supporting you in all different ways. And I came, you know, through a journey. It was a player and then volunteering and then part-time and now full-time member. And just look at me now, you know, I'm leading the team England. I'm so buzzing for that. It's an honor for me, you know, to doing that for the country as well. Hosted me and showed me love and showed me a sense of belonging and I made it home. So that's something really good, you know, to lead the team and to bring them here and then to give them this purpose, implementing these values, you know, on them as well. And I showed them as well my struggle and the way I became. I could be inspiring to them. Like I start from nothing. I came where like, I have no family. I came with such a really young age and now I'm trying to make something good and I'm trying to make history, you know, by bringing it home or like doing something great. Cause you know, when we start together and beginning of the tournament, we are like in very bad ranking, but right. I'm sure like now since the last five performances and the win, everyone knows like, listen, England has really great players.
Yeah.
So yes, never know about them, but yeah, I'm so proud of myself about the players as well. And hopefully, yeah, we'll do a great result.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a fantastic story and a wonderful testament as well to the power of sport and football, Frankie. You know, football at times comes in for a lot of criticism and the players at the top level too. But when you break it down to the basics of what this game can do, it has the ability to not only bring people together, but to actually change lives. And that's what you're doing there with this game.
It's true. My living in the UK, like, 95% the people I met is across football and the people that had really great impact in my life. So I always see like the football is universal language and it's always unite people together and bring them together. And this is what happened to me. Like I breathe football and I think like this is something very good and I really enjoy it. So yeah, football is something really great. And especially in this sort of things like Homeless World Cup, the way we do our session at Street Soccer or all these things, it's just, because we work with a community base and it's something very amazing.
And so how are you feeling about the tournament then? Obviously, things are going well at the moment. Frankie, how many games have you got to go and can you bring it home ultimately?
Hopefully, you know, I have the beliefs and then I trust on the guys. I spend a few months, you know, scouting them, speaking to them, doing session with them. And I think they've been really brilliant. And then I saw the confidence they grow in, you know, game after the game, you know. We always like, we made some mistakes, but we always learn from it. We get together, we break it down and then we go forward with it. Three games left, a game against Germany, then we have two games, one against South Africa and Mexico. I bet they're going to be a bit tough, but we're getting back to it because we have two tough games and it's really teaches us a lot against Bulgaria and Egypt. And now, yeah, and I see like, moving from defeat and then we bounce back and then winning, we want to implement this mentality to the players that you never give up, always yeah. believe in yourself and then have great confidence now. So, yeah.
And that is where it goes beyond football, isn't it? Is learning to cope with loss, learning to try and move forward and stay hopeful and optimistic. And just finally, what happens after the tournament then to the players?
So yeah, when we get back to the tournament, we all normally have like a tour program after the coming back, you know, from the tournament. So already I have players already volunteering. They're already like volunteering to our sessions and they want to carry over with different things. And this is our way to support them as well and show them like sort of supports. We work with different organization. We always like do referrals or like we benefit each other if there's courses, if there's any exchange, employment, you know. And this is what I try to get them into like employment or like any qualification. Some of them, they want to finish the education. Some of them, they want to carry on with coaching. Some of them, they will become a good professional footballers. And I can see the potential actually. And hopefully if I one or two of my players sign for the a pro, because they're really good.
Really? So you think you think they could actually end up playing for a club and making a living?
We have three players that already play semi-pro.
Right.
Yeah. So one in Ilford FC, and the other one I think in Williston, and the other thing in Maidstone. So this is the team semi-pro, and I think maybe they get an opportunity after this to play for any team, because I believe in the potential and the quality, and it's going to be a wonderful story, like a player, an ex-player from the Homeless World Cup, and he made it pro, and that's something good.
Imagine.
They deserve chance and deserve opportunity, and see them like through their the challenges and the tough time they became, and now they became stronger and stronger. I think we deserve opportunity. Yeah. The same way we give it to them, I'm sure like they will find another opportunity.
Hopefully. Yeah. Well, listen, more power to you, because you're doing amazing things out there, Frankie. Whatever happens, it sounds like you're changing lives. But fingers crossed you can bring it home. Good luck. Keep up the good work. Thank you so much for being with us, Frankie. Take care. Fantastic. What about that? That's Frankie Juma there, the England coach at the Homeless World Cup. Stay with us. It's the Midnight Musicology appointment on the way.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Charlotte Simpson. Health officials in Lebanon say nearly 500 people, including 35 children, have been killed by Israeli airstrikes. A spokesman for Israel's military said more than 1,000 targets had been hit, including cruise missiles and drones. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has tonight said he is deeply alarmed by the situation and repeated a call for a ceasefire. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, is in Jerusalem. He says further escalation could be difficult for Israel because of the conflict in Gaza.
Israel effectively is gambling. What it's hoping is that by doing what it's doing, it will coerce Hezbollah to stop firing into Israel. I think that that is probably unlikely. It means Israel will have to continue escalating, and the ultimate escalation would be moving troops and tanks into Lebanon.
Sir Keir Starmer will say there is light at the end of this tunnel as he addresses his first Labour conference as Prime Minister. He will warn of a shared struggle through short-term pressures. In his speech, he will talk about a goal of creating a Britain built to last as he signals his government will be decisive. Sarah Jones, a business and energy minister, says Labour needs to be honest with voters and agrees with the positive tone at the party conference.
Everywhere I go around the country, there are people with huge talent, and that talent is being held back. And it has to be the job of a sensible Labour government, in the interest of working people, to say this is a long-term plan for growth, because that is the only way this country is going to grow.
Nurses in England have rejected the government's award of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said two-thirds of the members who voted turned down the deal, with turnout at a record high. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
An RCN spokesperson said there was a fundamental shift in the determination of nursing staff to stand up for themselves, and that members did not feel valued. The rejection of the 5.5% pay award does not automatically mean there'll be a ballot for strikes, but that's not been ruled out. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said the government wanted to work with nurses to take the NHS from the worst crisis in its history and get it back on its feet.